He brought in Dan Ariely, who is like the forefather of this whole field study. It's called behavioral economics, which he writes that people are not rational. In fact, they're predictably not rational, that we are oftentimes influenced by framing of things. And he was looking at our pricing, and then I still remember the quote. He framed it was really telling and meaningful, and I think instructive, which he says, keep in mind that your $5 product is not $5 more expensive than your paid product. It is infinitely more expensive than your free product. And then he extended it and he said, you could price your product at 1 cent. And he said, 1 cent is not 1 cent more expensive than your free product. It is infinitely more expensive.
Welcome to In Depth, a show that surfaces tactical advice founders and startup leaders need to grow their teams, companies, and themselves. I'm Brett Burson, a partner at First Round, and we're a venture capital firm that helps startups like Notion, Roblox, Uber, and Square tackle company building firsts. On the In-Depth podcast, we share weekly conversations with startup leaders that skip the talking points and go deeper into not just what to do, but how to do it. Learn more and subscribe today at firstround.com. Today's episode of In Depth, I'm excited to be joined by Rich Rao. Rich is the VP of the Small Business Group for Meta, where he manages the global revenue and operations for properties including Facebook, Instagram, and WhatsApp. Before joining Meta, Rich spent 10 formative years at Google, starting all the way back in 2007, when he built the first customer support and operations model for enterprise customers. He held a bunch of different go-to-market roles at the company, eventually becoming the GM for the devices and education verticals. But Rich actually comes from a software engineering background, and in today's conversation, he applies a scientific lens to the go-to-market function. We start off by hearing the engineering influence in his approach to GTM, and how he applies the concept of refactoring to the typical go-to-market playbook. He also uses some examples from his time at Meta to illustrate why a roadmap is different from a goal system, even though folks tend to equate the two. Next, we wind back the clock to his earliest days at Google on the team that was building and selling Gmail for your domain. There are a ton of early startup lessons that Rich shares from this period in the company's history, including why they ended up ditching free trials and why you might want to consider doing the same. He also discusses pain-oriented buyers versus visionary buyers and why your business needs both in the early days. Finally, we end on Rich's biggest pricing lessons from working closely with renowned behavioral economics expert Dan Ariely. I hope you enjoy this inside look at the GTM playbooks powering Google and Meta. And now, onto my conversation with Rich. Well, thanks so much for joining us. Excited for the conversation. So I thought one interesting place to start is when you go all the way back to your college background, you actually came up in engineering. And I was curious, given the last 15 or so years of your career, you've dedicated to different facets of ops and go-to-market. How does that more technical background influence the way that you think about these topics?
I never thought about it in this way, but when I started my career, I was a software developer and I had studied electrical engineering as an undergraduate. I didn't realize it, but many years later, a lot of the lessons that I was learning, and it wasn't just the skill sets around problem solving or analytics, but the actual concepts of how to engineer a system came back to help me when I was building out go-to-market. And one of my first jobs was to build out some of the first e-commerce systems for businesses. And this was going back a long time, dating myself, but graduated in 97 and was building out, essentially at that point, it was Windows applications that ran locally on a client machine. And I basically learned how to go about doing it. You would build out a front end, you would build out the business logic, some amount of data and repository. You may replicate that data to a central place, but off you went. And then I built the first e-commerce system. And I tried to use that same architecture and I completely broke everything. And I built beautiful business logic and a beautiful front end, but I didn't think about the back end and the core architecture of how to write multi-threaded code or how to do load balancing or the cost of doing a round trip to the server. And so the application completely broke. And it wasn't until many years later that I was building go-to-market and I started to see I was making some of those same mistakes and that I was building components, but I wasn't thinking about the architecture. And that's just one example of how that engineering, experience really helped me. But I think there's a lot of factors. For example, building a product roadmap. Every company does that. You build a product, you have a roadmap, but most companies don't have a roadmap for go-to-market. Well, why is that? Shouldn't we have one? Refactoring is this other concept. There's a purpose to how you build your code, and over time, you increment it over time. And in some cases, it's actually better to hit the pause button on incrementally improving your code base and actually relook at it from the inside out. And so I think some of those concepts, I didn't realize at the time, but I was building and learning those things as I was an engineer, and it's really come back to help me on go-to-market.
Just to pick up one of the threads on this idea of a go-to-market roadmap, can you share in a little bit more detail kind of what that looks like for you and how you've used it as a tool?
A roadmap is fundamentally different than just a goaling system. I think oftentimes in go-to-market, what I've seen and experienced is that you have a goal and maybe it's revenue, maybe it's usage, maybe it's something else at the top line. And then you have KPIs underneath that support achieving the goal. And then oftentimes you have teams who are then working on some subsection of those goals and they kind of ladder up and all is fine and good. I think a roadmap takes it to the next level. I think in the same way that you build a product, you look at a roadmap and say, here's what I'm going to produce. And then everyone is working on that together in some mechanism where you all own a piece of it. I think what a roadmap on the go-to-market does is it forces you to say, what are you going to deliver beyond the revenue? What are the work streams? What are the programs? What are the initiatives? And then it creates working models for people to come together. And so on the product side, you may have an engineer and a UX person, a design person, a QA person. You have a product manager who's leading that. Well, similarly on the go-to-market, you can have sales, you can have marketing, you can have an ops person, and they're all working together against one of the deliverables on a roadmap. And then the other part about a roadmap that I like is this idea of having every 6 months, maybe it's every 3 months, but I like to use a roadmap that works every 6 months. It gives you enough time to actually have bigger enough ideas that you can execute and see results during that period. And every 6 months, you're producing something new. And so you can see how you're advancing your go-to-market. Just like you've advanced your product, you should be able to see advancement on your go-to-market in that same way.
Can you share an example from the last few years to bring to life what it looks like in practice?
A good example of it is in my time at Meta, we've used this principle of creating a roadmap. And one of the major programs that we have is one where we help advertisers optimize their accounts. And in particular, we find a lot of companies who are e-commerce, there's some sort of e-commerce type advertiser where they're trying to drive their business online and we help them optimize their ads. What we've done is essentially roadmap the improvements that we want to help our clients with. And it may start with some of the basics around getting started with advertising. And then, once you get some of the core measurement and campaign optimization set up, then you're ready for the next level. And so what we've done is essentially identified and done a lot of understand work or data science work to look at the heterogeneity of our clients and identify what would be the solutions that would make sense for these various subgroups of clients. And we have this expression that we want to meet clients where they are. And the only way you're going to be able to do that when you've got over 10 million advertisers is if you do it programmatically. And that's where I think a roadmap really comes in that you've got to decide which are the groups, which are the clusters that you want to focus in on, what are the different products you want to try and help them with, and then how can you measure the results of your efforts to see if you're actually helping and it's helping them and they're actually doing more and more business with you. So the roadmap, I think the concept of it is it's helpful to help you organize your efforts, but it's also equally as important such that you are reporting out on the learnings from it. I think one of the common misperceptions is that on a roadmap, you want everything to work or you want 70% of your goals to be reached. But I think of it as the learnings themselves are equally as valuable because it's a long game that you're playing. And so one of the major steps in any sort of roadmap item is to essentially do a full write-up and have it be as objective as possible as to you know, what went well, the issues, the challenges, the whys behind it, and the additional questions that may be looked at in a future roadmap item. And then, you know, at the end of the half, every team will then look at what they've delivered, and then we will prioritize what makes the roadmap for next quarter. So in this particular example, you know, we'll never be done because there's always a next set of products and next set of optimizations, but it allows us to look backwards as well and see the progress we've made and push ourselves as to the velocity of the changes that we want to make going forward.
So in this example of a part of the roadmap focused on improvements or optimizations for your end customers, can you give an example? If I was like looking at a doc that explains a piece of the roadmap, like what it actually would look like?
A good example that we can talk about right now is creative. And creative is a topic that I've written about in a few places. And it's this idea that we've seen creativity just hit a really sharp point of acceleration. And if you think about going back to even advertising at a basic level, it was very text-based. And then we got to television and radio even before that, and then television and then online. And I think we're generally seeing creativity as one of the key competitive advantages when it comes to how a company will market themselves. And so part of a roadmap item would be, an example would be, we want to help our clients with creativity. We want to help fuel their creativity. We want to unlock it. And there may be various ways that we can do that. We can help them with providing really good in-product support so that they can take their current stock image and really make it into something that brings their business to life. We can do tutorials and training online. People want to learn how to do this. It's not just get it done, but they also want to develop new skills and produce something that they're really proud of. For some clients, they want it just to be done. They want to work with an agency, or they want some sort of third-party automated tool. And so we'll actually develop, in a lot of ways, all of those different ways that we can help clients, and then we'll test it. We'll actually run a measured ABC test to identify what the impact was and know what worked. And probably in the end, we're going to take bits and pieces from all those different ideas. Then we will actually, for the next roadmap, we'll identify what makes the cut. And ideally, we'd be pushing the envelope on innovation even further, given the results that we saw.
So let's zoom out a bit. How would you describe the pieces or the parts of go-to-market architecture or infrastructure?
It's important to understand the pieces. And then, as I mentioned before, the architecture, think about how it all works together. And it's confusing because there's a lot of buzzwords that are out there. And we've seen a lot over the last decade. There's product-led growth. There's using a data-driven approach. Everyone wants to do high scale, customer centricity. But as I was getting into go-to-market, I started to think about like, well, what's the right tool for the job? And how do I think about, is there a unifying theory that could help bring together these various pieces and actually produce some sort of amplification effect? And the solution that I sort of came upon, and I've seen it work in multiple businesses, is this idea of having an integrated multi-channel system. And this is this idea that there's many ways, there's multiple channels in which you can go to market. There's the product. You can do it with one-to-one human capital. There's various types of marketing. You can do it with partners. And in a proper, what I'm calling an integrated multi-channel system, each of these channels provides differential and distinct value and significant value, and then works in concert with the rest of the system, such that it makes the system better with a contribution that's truly distinct and discernible. And so let's start with where it usually begins, which is the product. And a lot of companies are using their product to kind of sell the product, and you go through it and you get it set up. And self-service is really good, but it goes beyond. And I think if you think about what is the core value or differential value that the product brings to the system of going to market, it's that, well, it has near infinite scale, and it's typically the fastest path for a customer. But there's an issue with it, which is it's really difficult to do two-way and recursive and iterative back and forth with a customer or a client who may be confused. It's also really difficult to do customization. If you imagine there's a flywheel with this integrated multi-channel system, and the product is at the core of it. It's like at the 12 o'clock position, if you can imagine that on the flywheel. But then the next piece is where you have one-to-one interaction. And this is where you can do, the distinct value is that you can do this sort of two-way recursive inquiry. You can uncover the issues. You can see the actual challenges that people have. You can understand intention. You can identify the corner cases. And it's typically your fastest path to resolve it. So I'll give you an example. When I was working at Google, we were building this business. Early days, it was called Gmail for your domain. It was Google Apps and it was called Google Workspace, but it took effort and time and it was a challenge to set up and get it deployed. And there was a rollout process, there was change management. And so, you know, one-to-one interaction is really, really important for figuring those things out. And as you figure it out, you can then identify what should be different. And then your product, you know, can use that information to get better and to scale. And so human, I put like the one-to-one human pieces, say like on this flywheel that we're virtually drawing here, it's like at a 2 o'clock position. But it doesn't end there. And I think that's when you get into more of the scale type channels. So it's product, it's one-to-one. And then you go to the next part of the flywheel, which would be personalized scaled outreach or marketing. And that personalized part is really, really, really important here. And the goal for this part of the system and this part of your go-to-market design is you want to automate what works. Maybe you found something in that one-to-one. So in the case of Google Apps, we found out the deployment, here are the methods to do it. Well, maybe you're not ready to put it quite in the product yet, right? Because if you don't get it exactly right, and if you can't get the instructions right, it won't work. But maybe you can test that with personalized marketing. So you can take what you're doing one-to-one, identify groups of people who could benefit, and then apply measurement and data science techniques to actually see what the end results are through instruction itself. And the benefit of this is that you don't have humans adding additional variables to the experiment. You don't have these unobserved variables that are happening. And so you get highly objective and deterministic results, and it's a broader reach than one-to-one. And an example, just picking another one from Meta, is this idea of campaign optimization. So as we talked about, a large part of what we do is we help our clients optimize their campaigns. But we are seeing this pattern over and over again through one-to-one, which was that people would oftentimes get their targeting. It would either be too restrictive or too wide. And we could help them get a better performance by making that change. And we started to see like, well, why don't we, if we can identify in advance and advise them, why don't we do that and then send them in product notification or send them an email or send them a message, and then they can accept it or they can deny it and they can still be in control. So that's a way to automate some of what's happening one-to-one. And then the next part of the flywheel, if we kind of zoom ahead, maybe, I don't know where we are, but like 7 o'clock on the flywheel, once you've tested with personalized marketing, now it's time to go broad. You're ready to go with broad reach. And then you get into broad self-service platforms like your website, help centers, you can do webinars, on-demand content and high volume. And this is the place where you want to have the most robust answers, where you want everyone to read it and know about it when it comes to your product or how to use your product. An example I'll share from Meta is that when I talked about optimizing campaigns, we figured out there's a lot of different ways to do it. There's probably hundreds of different ways, but there are 5 things that are probably the most critical for a category of advertisers. So then we can produce the content on that. We can embed experts in a webinar. We can write our website such that you want to come back to it over and over again, and we can update the content. And again, we have brought, it's a much broader reach than say personalized campaigns that go to people. So it's got the upside of really being able to affect a broad market, but there is a downside in that it does require maintenance. And I think oftentimes I've made that mistake, and I've seen others make that as well, of you produce content and the more you produce, the more you have to maintain as well. And so you've got to do that. Otherwise, it signals to the market and to your customers that, hey, maybe your world and maybe your product really isn't that dynamic. And then the last piece of the flywheel, so maybe at like 10 o'clock, is partners. To date, everything that we've talked about so far is really around your product in a direct channel of service. But you know, partners in many types of businesses, I definitely saw this at Google, I've seen it at Meta, that partners extend your reach to places that are not well served or not served at all in some cases. And what I saw from Google is that what the partners really did is they helped remodel the business itself. When you move to cloud computing, all of a sudden, like it's a completely different paradigm and your business use cases and business workflows change. So it's a strategic function. The customer gets value. The partner gets value because that's a valuable service that they can then price accordingly. But then it also liberates you and your product team to do what it does well, which is really produce a product that's easy, simple, powerful, and allows you to build for a broad base of customers and do it really quickly, which is important when you're in a competitive market. And that brings us back to the top part of the flywheel. So in a well-functioning system, you kind of have all of those channels. Maybe there's more, maybe there's a little bit less, but they're all working together.
That's a really great set of ideas and framing. To go a click deeper on it, What are the tools or processes or systems to actually make this work or make the flywheel turn? Maybe one way to get it would be like if you were to go join another company and build this from scratch, like what's the how behind this?
Yeah, so I kind of described a system that sounds relatively sophisticated and may sound a bit daunting to go say, okay, let's go build this all of a sudden. But, you know, I think in the early days, you don't have to get it all from the beginning. I think I can kind of share with you some of the early days of what it was like working on Google Apps, and that'll show you that it's not about building that end system from the very beginning. It's really about having it in your mind and then working towards it. You know, the early days of working on Google Apps, like it had no semblance of scale or the system that we're talking about. Now, it was a different era. It was going back, it was 2007. This was the early days of cloud computing, and we were selling Gmail for your domain. And, you know, our role at that point, my job was really two parts. In one part, it was being a part evangelist, because in that era, cloud computing for business wasn't a certainty. You know, our biggest competitor said it wasn't a thing. Might have been Larry Ellison who said he called it gibberish in reference to cloud computing. And now we weren't too worried about what other people were saying about it, but it's useful to know what we were up against. Now, thankfully, Nicholas Carr wrote this book, and it was called The Big Switch, and it professed this movement that would be cloud computing. And he told this compelling analogy between cloud computing and electricity, and how electricity, as we now know it, became commonly available in a low-cost utility. It wasn't always like that. And the story went that electricity used to be produced very locally for a manufacturing plant or some local homes, but it was very costly to distribute. And then he tells the story that all that changed with the advent of alternating current that allowed for this low-loss distribution of power over long distances. And next, this similar phenomenon was about to unfold with the internet, and that the internet was the equivalent of alternating current that would allow for this massive centralized computing to be distributed to anywhere in the world. And Google would be at the forefront of it. And so we go around and preach this message and get people excited. And Dave Girard was a master of it. So we watched him, and then we kind of created this golden pitch. And so we go out evangelizing. And then we go back to our desks, and then we would do the second part of our job, which was not a very glorious job, but it was basically answering tickets in the queue that were submitted online. And people were asking basic questions about how to use your product. Like, I understand I need to switch my DNS records. How do I do that? And what exactly are these DNS records? And so it was really a humble beginning, you know, on the business side. But I remember trying to build out the go-to-market, and I was kind of pulling inspiration from a few different places, because there wasn't like a great example of trying to build this system or build a system for scale in the market. And I pulled a lot of inspiration from, at that point, I was working as part of Sheryl Sandberg's org, who was building out the online sales engine for ads at Google. And then I had a background in enterprise software, and Salesforce was the preeminent SaaS model. Now, they were doing things in a very high cost and high touch way, but they were, you know, we were able to look at some of the ways that they were working and pull from some of those learnings. And then Google had this aspiration of like always building out these billion user applications and doing things at the scale of the internet. And so we had this, you know, ambition to try and do something that rivaled that in the go-to-market. But the early days were just building out some of the core components. And that's where I think every company starts. It's like, what is the MVP on the go-to-market to get customers and to drive revenue? And in those days, it was building an online website, payments and billing. You know, at Google, and there was a system built for ads, but it didn't work for subscriptions. So we had to figure out how to port that. This concept of an online trial, which we should talk more about at some point in this conversation, it was useful at the beginning, came back to hurt us in some ways later on. A CRM system, analytics, and then an inside sales machine. And I remember the first days of that, we didn't even measure our sales, but in the first quarter we did, it was around $50,000 per person, per sales rep per quarter. And I remember thinking, how is Google possibly going to pay for this? Why would they invest in this business versus ads? And what we didn't know at the time, but what I learned, is that we were able to quickly multiply that. We were able to 5X that until we got to $1 million as the goal. And once we had that, we said, okay, we have the start of a business here. And, you know, I think in a lot of ways, that's where businesses start. Those are the first steps.
When you go back to this experience building at Google, and I assume this sort of unifying theory of GTM is something that crystallized over the course of the last 10 or 15 years, but maybe when it was much more of a learn by doing or figuring out kind of thing. Were there big unlocks along the way or aha moments as you went from grinding and scraping it together to seeing some things work and some things that didn't in that journey at Google?
There were those moments along the way for sure. And I think part of what helped us was this idea of refactoring that I mentioned before, of looking at everything that we're doing and building and then openly and proactively questioning it in a positive way, in a way that doesn't put people on the defensive, but says like, oh, is there something else that we could be doing here? And an example of which is, I mentioned that concept of a trial, which, you know, if you go back to what I was saying about the early days, like a trial made sense. You needed to have a way for people to, in a low risk way, come in, try your product. And then if they decided that it works for them, then they can keep it. And if not, you know, no problem. What we saw as we were building out components around this architecture and was really built up around this trial. And it was a website, the main call to action was a trial. Yeah, you could contact sales. Yeah, you could get support. Yeah, you could check out different pieces. But it really was focused on like, get into the trial. Everything happens from the trial. We saw that there were some challenges from that. And what had happened was we were struggling with a low conversion problem. I mean, we were able to make some advancements as we made improvements. We saw some increase in the conversion rate, but we really struggled with this idea. And I think the bigger we got, the more we saw that, well, for everyone who goes through the trial and fails, that's a lost opportunity, not only now, but in the future. And so you don't want to churn through potential customers in that way. And so a breakthrough happened when we really got deep into understanding intent. And I see a lot of companies do this, and I've done this myself, but you really obsess and create metrics around outcomes. You measure what happened. You measure the funnel. You measure the drop-off. You measure what happened with the experiment. You measure the outcomes. But I started to ask, and we started to look at it and say, like, do we really understand the intent of what people are trying to do? And that's when one of the breakthrough happens. And we went back to some of the people who had fallen out of the funnel, who went through the trial, failed, and we went and asked them, well, what happened? What was your experience? And they told us, well, I struggled with this. I struggled with that. Like, it's just, I didn't see enough value here. And then we asked another question, which was like, well, what were you trying to do? What attracted you to begin with? And what we realized was that we didn't fully understand the intent of what people were coming in to do. And one of the things we picked up on was that there was a huge number of people who were coming to actually buy the product who didn't need a trial. They knew they wanted it. They had used Gmail. They wanted Gmail for their domain. And they were getting stuck in a trial process when really what they wanted was to make the purchase and then get it set up and off and running. And it turned out when we did some of the analytics on it, we were turning back more people who had high purchase intent than we were gaining from people who had low purchase intent. So you could argue that in many ways, we were doing no better with the trial than, say, just like a buy now button, where you'd get all the people who wanted to buy. And then, yeah, people wouldn't be able to, who had passing interest, wouldn't be able to try it, but maybe they could get in contact with you and contact sales and go from there. And so it led to a much deeper inspection of what we're doing. And then we started to see all sorts of problems. Like when you did go through a trial, there was no help versus if you contacted sales, you'd get this sort of white glove treatment where we'd roll out the red carpet for you. And so we started to ask, well, like, why is that? Why is it that the click of one button, one call to action would give you two very different experiences? And then that question of, well, what exactly are people trialing? Are they trialing your setup experience or do they want to trial using your product? And Gmail people understood what that was. Docs was really growing and gaining traction. People were understanding what that was. So it led to a rethink of the entire model. And we actually created almost a project to sort of rebuild from the bottoms up. And that included the product flows, that included the trial, that included what would happen when you took different action on the page. If you contacted sales, would there be help in the trial? And eventually it moved into a different paradigm. It may sound like a small shift, but it was more of a get started. So we found a way to still de-risk it if you weren't satisfied with it. But that changed, you know, when we got the billing information and when we asked for that in the flow and when we presented various upsells for a different SKU along the way, and it helped get the business to the next level. But it started with that idea of sort of questioning what we are doing. Did that still make sense? And then really getting intent level information on what customers were trying to do.
So you've touched on the idea of refactoring both in this awesome story that you just shared and earlier in the conversation. How is that instantiated in the teams or companies that you've worked at? Is there a ritual or process that you follow that increases the chances that you have these kind of breakthroughs you just shared?
I don't know if there's any sort of practice to it, but I do think that it takes a sort of characteristic of curiosity. And what I mean by that is we'll have teams that do understand work. And it's not just teams. We have everyone who participates in kind of a formal understand phase of any sort of program initiative that we're doing. And so one of the common practices that I used at Google was we could jump pretty quickly to action. But even in this example here that was from Google, you saw that really the breakthrough happened when we got really deep into what was happening and why and intent. And so formally, we will at Meta do what's called an understand phase to any initiative that we're taking on. We'll do an understand phase. We'll then develop a hypothesis. We'll then construct some sort of experiment around it. We'll then test it. We'll measure it. We'll report out on it. But it starts with that understand phase. And I think the best practice and what's really brought this to life and made this something that's very meaningful is that the output of it is really just to publish what you're seeing and what you're understanding. And then people will ask questions about it and pose further questions. So it creates a sort of community and this culture of doing understand work for the sake of understanding. And one example of a really successful program happened because we tried it multiple times and failed, and people published results of what happened. And then we went back and reread the report, and we saw that there was new information that was coming out that maybe led to a different understanding of what could potentially be happening. In this specific example, it was advertiser onboarding. We were seeing that there were some advertisers who were able to figure it out and they really saw success, they saw value, they were able to grow. In other cases, they wouldn't quite get the results. And maybe that was a result of our product being pretty much like a choose your own adventure. You figure out what you want to do. And we had several attempts to help with onboarding new advertisers, and we couldn't really get lift. We tried multiple things, and it wasn't until I think it was the third or fourth time that we tried again. And we went back to the original experiments that were done. We reread the write-ups, and we started to realize that, you know what, it wasn't just in each of those previous experiments, we were trying to isolate for maybe one core hypothesis that people weren't setting up their budget correctly, or they needed guidance as to what would happen, or maybe the cost was too high. We had all these hypotheses, but what really unlocked the next successful experiment was that we put it all together. And then we started to ask, well, what if it's not one factor, but it's a lot of these factors coming together? We're able to sort of, before we formed a formal experiment, test it out and start kind of do some usability work with some of our advertisers before we felt like, okay, we've got something new here. And then eventually, you know, we got the experiment to work. We saw a lift, and then we're able to go about the flywheel and try to build some of the improvements into the product. But what got it all started was this idea of looking again at the problem and sitting with the problem. I'll use that phrase oftentimes. My team will hear me say it, but let's just sit with the problem. Sit with the problem long enough, let it come to you a bit, go back and be a historian, and then new ideas emerge. And then the natural inclination, people get excited when they've got a new idea or a new angle on something, and the rest kind of follows.
And in this understand phase, is a deliverable like a specific doc or piece of content? And is there a format to it, or everybody decides how they want to crystallize the insights that they've gathered in that first phase?
There's a benefit of having creative liberty in it. I mean, what I've seen work really well is a document with the written word can actually explain it with nuance, with ordering, with a theme or story that goes behind it. You know, occasionally a slide deck. But what's more important than the specific format is really the depth of the insights. And it can take weeks. I've seen understand projects take 6 weeks where you're really trying to get to, maybe it's the heart of a very complicated issue that cuts across parts of the organization. You've got to do interviews with people as well to get their take and input into it. It's not just something where you go off in a room with a data scientist and a business leader and a marketer and go figure out like, okay, this is it. We've solved it. We've come to the understanding of what it is. But it happens in participation with a running, functioning organization. And so that's where I've seen the model actually get the most traction is when you enroll the participation of the organization. A frame that I like to use to encourage that is this idea of the ladder of inference, which is this concept that oftentimes, like the mistake that I've seen, and I've made it myself plenty of times, is that you jump straight to a conclusion as to, okay, I'm seeing a problem, here's what we should go do about it. And really what's happening in a process that you're going through is that, you know, you want to start at the, if you imagine there's this ladder, but you want to start at the bottom of this ladder. Like at the top are the actions you're going to take. And at the bottom is like, not just the data you've selected, but actually the entirety of the universe of data. And I think when you realize, like, when you select data, you're actually adding a potential bias to that. You've selected some of the data. And so the first step in doing like really good understand work is just to say, what is the universe of data that's available to us? And then say, okay, here's the set of data that I'm going to select to get that deeper level of understanding. And then from that data, here's what I'm seeing from that. Here are the intricacies. Here's what the oddities. Here's the interpretations of that. And then from that, I'm going to then draw some, maybe some, I don't want to say conclusions, but some insights as to what could help. What are the beliefs? What are the hypotheses that could change or influence that situation? And then lastly, what are the actions? And I think, you know, oftentimes we'll jump into the middle of the ladder and then go try to go straight up when people are self-selecting different sets of data. So I think that's what, you know, I've seen is more the typical pattern of really good and deep understand work is like using that ladder of inference, bringing people along in that. And then, as I mentioned, it's a mix of heavy quantitative and qualitative data that leverages customer insights, partner insights, but also insights from teams, insights from sales as to what they're challenged with, what they're hearing, which sometimes you can't capture that information in a database as to looking again at outcomes. I mentioned before the value of getting intelligence as to intent. Well, where is intent stored? Like, where do you have information on that? But I think if you first start with this idea of like, well, what's the universe? What data do I want to select? Then you run a really broad spectrum and identify the various pieces that could go towards it. And then over time, you start to coalesce and you narrow down the data set, you narrow down the set of possibilities. You start to get maybe the answer that you thought at the beginning that would emerge has actually emerged, but you've gone through the process and you've got people behind you and you've got more confidence that that's the right path forward as well.
One of the things that popped to mind as you're explaining some of the things you've figured out, particularly in the earlier phases of bringing a product to market, is that I think that there's this common problem in creating new products where the actual value that you can deliver to a given customer if they use the thing or do the thing is significant, but there's obviously activation energy to get to that unit of value. And depending on the customer base, they're often very skeptical customers or customers that may have another priority at that point in time. So working at bringing so many different types of products to market, is there anything you figured out about different strategies or techniques to get over that hump? Maybe other than the most obvious thing that everybody talks about, well, it's just reduce the friction to get to the unit of value. But anything else that comes to mind?
Yeah, I think friction is one of those often used phrases, and there's certainly a lot there. But I think one of the things, especially early on in a company's lifespan, is to set yourself up for a friction reducing type cycle or process. You've got to get to that min viable product and min viable go to market and really a formula for success. And then once you have that, once you have the solution, once you have some of the core components, then you could focus on velocity. And through velocity comes scale. And, you know, friction is one of the tools that's used in that phase. But I think what I've seen and used is, and no matter whether it's a very early stage business like Google Apps, where we started with literally zero revenue and we were trying to get our first customers and get to millions and then tens of millions, or a business the scale of Meta, is this idea of a lighthouse account program. It's not rocket science, but it's a really powerful construct I found organizationally, internally, and with your customers as well. And the way I describe it is a lighthouse account program is basically a program to identify and select top exemplary accounts, top customers who want to partner with you, who want to help you build the right capabilities, and who ultimately, you know, are going to speak on your behalf as well. So if they work, if it works for them, they're going to shine the light for others to follow, so to speak. And so that's why it's called a lighthouse account program. Actually, just to back up a little bit, what do you have to do? Like, who is a good candidate for a lighthouse account program is typically a question when you're going to form this. And so you have to think very critically about what are the use cases you're trying to solve for. Is there a specific type of product capability or something that you're trying to make sure it really works for a set of customers. You know, you talked about this idea of like early stage, you have to overcome some amount of barrier. It takes time, it takes energy, it takes something. So you have to align on those use cases of where is there value such that the client, such that the customer is going to want to put forward that effort because there's something very promising there. You want to have people who understand the vision of what you're trying to do and get excited about it. You want to have a sponsor who, you know, a person who is essentially on the hook along with you, and they've got to be willing to accept beta quality. And one of the frames within this to identify who would be good Lighthouse account programs is this idea of, if you overly simplify it, you could basically say there are two types of sales. There's some sort of pain, there's some sort of a way, or some sort of two. There's some sort of pain that I'm trying to alleviate, and hence I want that pain to go away, and hence I'm very motivated to do the work to then get that release of pain. Or there's some sort of pleasure, something that's like transformational, something that's visionary, something that's going to help compel me forward. Advertising is a great example. That's going to move my business forward. Maybe it's not a pain point, but I can grow my business if I can get my ads to work really, really well. So you want to make sure that whoever it is you're working with in the early days, especially with the Lighthouse account program, they are motivated by maybe it's one of those two things. And so hence, they're going to be willing to accept beta quality. They're going to work with you on the most critical use cases. They're going to give you real honest feedback because they want it to work as much as you do. And then eventually, when it does work, they're going to tell the world. Now, the reason why I think that that's so important, when you have that, if you have that alignment, if you have that partnership, these customers end up being worth their weight in gold because you're going to learn so much. You're going to develop new capabilities. It's going to be an internal rallying cry for people to really celebrate when you achieve success. And then, you know, it's going to require the whole company. It's going to require not just your go-to-market teams, but your product and eng teams, your operations teams, your finance teams. You create this sort of war room environment where you're working every week and every day. You're doing a lot of iterations. And that's a method by which then when you get those accounts and things just happen naturally much faster. And so if there's something new we're trying to get into, you know, at Meta, or if there's a new business that I'm building, that's one of the critical first steps. I create that program, get those accounts, and then you can focus on reducing friction and velocity and expansion and adding capabilities that will help you build a complete product.
Any thoughts on how to appropriately qualify those early customers that could be Lighthouse accounts, or things that you've learned when you thought someone would be a great Lighthouse account and ended up not working out that might illustrate a point for listeners?
The reality is you're going to get some of it wrong. You're going to have more accounts in the program who end up not making it through or fall out for one reason. But I spoke a little bit about it. I think probably the most critical factor is these are, you know, especially in the early days, like cases where you're invested at a personal level, where you know the name of the sponsor, of the executive, of the key people working on it, and it almost feels like an extension of your company. I remember in the early days of Google Apps, you know, the customer was Arizona State University, and that was the first account, and that was the account, and they saw the promise and the vision of cloud computing. There was a CIO who was really trying to push the envelope on technology and understood that user-based applications and giving, you know, in those days, even today, you know, college students, they want to use Google, they want to use Gmail as their school domain account. But he understood that, hey, we've got to modernize. We've got to go in that direction. So I think oftentimes it's about working with someone who has a vision, which you feel like they could be doing the pitch for you. They could equally evangelize us. In fact, they will oftentimes do it even better than you will. And that's one of the things we saw. And, you know, some of the early success for us came in education. And we were evangelizing, but we had these evangelists who were able to sell it and position it and even competitively talk about it in a way that was way more compelling than we were able to. And I think it takes that kind of vision because you go into these programs not having all the answers. You're not going in saying, hey, we just need to like overcome this barrier. We have a great product that the world just needs to see. People just need to understand it and feel it and see it. No, that's not what happens. You go in with, yeah, you believe that when you go in, but then that client, that person, that sponsor, that visionary is going to push you on it and say like, you know what, that's good, but what would be even better is this. And sure enough, those early stage education customers really pushed us on building a complete product, on building accessibility features and figuring out how to go into international markets. We all had frameworks for how we thought about the world, but you know, frankly, your customers are living in that world more than you are. So I think that's a critical part of it, and making sure you're going to have people who are going to challenge you and who are going to push you. And frankly, you should get excited about where they want to go as well. Like, I think we were so excited about the CIO of Arizona State and what he wanted to do. That really compelled us to try and give him what he needed to realize that vision.
Going back to the idea that sales can orient it around a pain to be alleviated or some pleasure or future state that somebody might want to get to. When you think about all the different Lighthouse account programs that you've set up and early customers that you've worked with, are each of those personas equally as successful, or in the early days is one better than the other?
You know, I think they provide different values and virtues to you as a company. The pain buyers are ones who can provide you with crystal clarity as to what really matters, what it is they're trying to solve, what are the core features they really need, what's the min viable case for it to work, and how much is it worth to them. So in the case of Google, it was, we were selling Gmail as an enterprise capability for you to run your email. And we were really competing with, at that point, on-premise email servers. And so the pain that people felt was that either the servers, they couldn't keep them up, so they were just downtime, or they would get hit with tons of spam and they couldn't filter out the spam and deal with the various threats that were growing and emerging in the market. And so that was the pain. And so we offered a solution to that. Gmail knows how to handle spam, and you know, the uptime was incredibly high. So that we were able to solve. But then it came down to, well, how much does it cost, and how do I run it, and how do I make sure I have control of my data, and what are my rights to the data, and how do I make sure users are not doing crazy things, and so forth. So pain attracted buyers, essentially, but we still had to go through and figure out, what are all the objections? What are the challenges? What's the price point? What's this really worth to them? And for some customers, they thought like, no, I actually have it under control, or maybe there's another alternative that's a little bit less expensive, or maybe I want some additional integration capabilities with this other third-party software that I have, and it didn't work for them. But for most of those customers, it really worked, and it worked really well. And so we're able to get velocity, get traction, get customer wins, and then we use that to build out capability. We use that to build out our customer service. Okay, now that we won these customers, how do we support them? They don't have as much control, so we have to figure out how to be there for them for when they need something, and to get them visibility into what was happening. You know, I remember in the early days, we didn't really have a static dashboard when the service went down. The service would go down. You know, it would happen. It would happen rarely. But when it happened, it was a really big deal because there was no alternative. It was all cloud-based. But even more importantly, they didn't know what was happening. They didn't have the status. They couldn't tell their CEO what was going on. They couldn't report out. They couldn't take activity that would help the situation. And so it was a total loss of control. And so we had to figure out ways to give them control. So people who have pain, they're looking for a solution, but you're not done just by putting out that pain. There's oftentimes other things that come along with that, especially if it's a paradigm shift and really a, you know, category changing or a new category of product. The pleasure buyers, those are the ones you have to be, I think, particularly careful with. The pain buyers are going to come to you and tell you, like, here's my pain, please put it out, like a physician. The visionary buyers, the people who are buying towards something, there's a lot of vision that's out there, and it's going to all look and feel very differently. And what's really important there is you've got to scan the landscape and figure out who it is you want to align with and what they're trying to do. And in the early days, I think the suite that we were selling, like Gmail, was a pain-based purchase. And, you know, but no one ever says, like, I really want great email and next level email. Like, yeah, there were some great productivity features and some unique features at that time around priority inbox and smart filtering and so forth. But really what that visionary sale was towards a different collaboration model. And there we were competing with people working in isolation and working on their own independent machines, and then some amount of synchronization that was happening. It felt very like pre-internet days. And so we were just creating internet-based apps and collaboration. And, you know, now we accept it. That's how we work. That's how we collaborate in general. But at that point, it was not really accepted. So you had to find the people who, you know, weren't going to, you know, work with you because they thought they were going to get, you know, they couldn't translate that into money necessarily, but they were aiming for a cultural shift within their organization. They wanted their teams to work differently. They wanted things to happen much faster. They wanted, and they saw that the tool was a mechanism to do that. But it started by, you know, essentially identifying like who are the people who really have that vision. And then you know, some people fell out of the funnel because, you know, maybe priorities change, business shifts, business conditions happen, leaders change, all of that stuff would happen. But through that process, if we had 10 to go through the initial stages, you could get a handful, you can get one handful that come through, and then those end up being incredibly powerful and this multiplier effect that ended up happening in the market.
So something we didn't speak about yet, and I'm really interested in any frameworks, mistakes, ideas as it relates to early pricing. You know, maybe it's your first 10, 50, 100 customers, you're first bringing a product to market.
Yes, tons of lessons here. I'll just try to give you a couple of them here. But the first is this idea of anchoring. And you know, when we first came out with the pricing for Google Apps, it was pretty simple. It was, you know, just $50 a user a year, US dollar, and then change per market based upon currency. And the great thing about it, it was very simple, very easy to understand. It was low cost relative to the solutions. But that ended up anchoring not only the price point for us, because you're building off of that as you add new capability, but it also does it for the market itself. And maybe that was a good thing. Maybe that's where it needed to go. And maybe we were the company that helped drive the prices towards that level. And, you know, I believe in efficient market theory. So maybe that gave us more impetus for innovation to drive more value and then more revenue. So maybe that was the right thing, but it definitely anchored the price for the market. And so I think that's one thing you have to think about. The other thing that I would probably do in an early stage company is, in retrospect, I would have brought in a behavioral science or behavioral economics group or consultant or capability sooner. And the story I'll use is around, when we first started, it was a freemium model. So we had a free product and then we had a paid product. And then we tried to differentiate on capability and we did a decent job as we, you know, as we went, we built more capability into the paid product. The free product just helped us, you know, get our product out there and people start using it. And it was a really good thing. But at some point we were growing as a big business and we knew we could grow faster, but potentially that free product may have been slowing us down, as the upgrade path wasn't as strong as we thought it would be. And we were debating a lot internally. In fact, it took years of discussion, debate before we got to a different place. But what really helped us was when we brought in Dan Ariely, who, for those who don't know him, Dan Ariely is like the forefather of this whole field of study. It's called behavioral economics. And it basically says, I think he wrote a book called Predictably Irrational, which he writes that people are not rational. In fact, they're predictably not rational, that we are oftentimes influenced by framing of things. And he was looking at our pricing and he was looking at our pricing page and he was asking us, so, okay, what is in the free product and what do you get? And we're like, well, you get Gmail and you get Docs and you get Drive and you get all these things. And he's like, okay, well, what do you get in the paid product? And we're like, well, you get that. Plus you get support and you get more storage for Drive and you get these additional, you know, management capabilities to manage your IT, et cetera. And he was asking about those things. And then I still remember the quote. He said, your paid product is not sufficient to differentiate from the free product. And we're like, ah, and the people in the room who were saying that were like, aha, yes, you see, he's telling us what we thought. And then there were the skeptics in the room. But then the way he framed it was really telling and meaningful, and I think instructive, which he says, keep in mind that your $5 product is not $5 more expensive than your paid product. It is infinitely more expensive than your free product. And then he extended it and he said, you could price your product at 1 cent. And he said, 1 cent is not 1 cent more expensive than your free product. It is infinitely more expensive. And it was at that point that we knew that, huh, okay, that is a completely different way to look at it. And I think we had spent so long and spent so many years and building, and we believed in the features we were building that we just couldn't see it that way. And so pricing is one of those things I've worked with and advised some companies, and I've looked at their pricing page. And one of the other lessons around it is around making it intuitive, such that your pricing is so obvious that you don't have to think about it. You know, oftentimes I'll see a calculator on the page, or you have a scroll, you know, you have this kind of like various forms of UI that allow you to toggle your pricing based upon users or this or that. And it's hard to understand. And that just creates friction and it creates uncertainty. And so I think giving people choices early in their process that they can make, that they can confirm, and then they can get a positive feedback that makes sense is really important. The first step of setting a Google Apps, we would ask people is, what is your domain name? And, you know, businesses would kind of like freeze at that page because they're like, what is a domain name? What does this mean? What if I choose do you want a new domain name? And then if they choose one, is it going to be locked in? And sure enough, they would have been locked in. So creating this anxiety around the very first question that we're asking. And I think that that comes up as well when it comes to pricing, that it can be confusing, it can be daunting, it can be complicated. And you know, you're potentially signaling to your customers that, hey, maybe this isn't for you, or maybe you got to take more time on this. Maybe you're going to have to think harder about this. And I think those are all points that can introduce friction and slow down the business.
On that interesting story that you shared about going from a free product to even charging a penny that was kind of surfaced in your work with Dan Ariely, what was the conclusion of that sort of insight or line of thinking?
I think the main insight that, and takeaway from this, from that example, was that we were approaching it from the inside out. Like we had this frame of the world that we should have a breath play with the free product. We should then have a paid product that's really good, but really low cost, so it was super valuable. And then some sort of like super premium SKU for people who wanted these advanced capabilities. And I think that that construct was right, but then how you go about implementing it with, you know, there were too many SKUs, essentially. There were too many products, and that actually hurt the business. And I think the takeaway was, I think it was probably the right thing at the very beginning, you know, when we launched the product, to have that free product, to have a paid product that was very simple. But then we started to get, as we worked with and won big customers, enterprise level customers, the need for more of what I call like the illities, like the reliability, extensibility, and even words that don't rhyme in illity, but that are really important, like security and compliance and, you know, certain industry regulatory, you know, certification. And so that all takes time and effort and money, and that's reflected in your price. So we created, you know, additional capability for that. But we never went back to that breath play and said, like, do we still need that? And I think that's one of the learnings of, you've got to evolve your product over time. It's really hard to do, again, because of the anchoring that I talked about. You create a certain mindset as to how to think about your product. It's hard to raise prices as well. You know, you're adding capability with a lot of SaaS models. People get used to that and they want more value over time, and you should be producing more value over time. And so early on, I think, you know, in retrospect, it's really good to define some boundaries as to the essence of each of the products used. Like, what is it that goes in it is sort of something that follows. But in essence, we were building a basic model for general business use and then one with sophisticated enterprise capabilities. And I think that should have been priced as such for those customers who really value that, because it was going to take development effort. And I think one of the learnings was that it took a lot more development effort than what we thought it would take. And hence, you know, we probably didn't set the price point appropriately to allow us to continue to invest at that level. So seeing how what the market needs now, but then also doing things in a way that doesn't restrict you from evolving in the future, and doing it in partnership with your customers as well. I mean, one of the things that I learned was that I was worried that people would worry about a pricing change if we added this capability or that. But, you know, oftentimes that once you've become part of a company's enterprise and part of their platform, you know, they want those additional capabilities. And if it was valuable to begin with already for them to pay you, it's probably going to be valuable for them to pay you a little bit more to develop the capabilities. They just want it to make sense. Like I think at the end of the day, the pricing has to be explainable. Like if they can explain your pricing for you, and by the way, they will, they're going to have to explain it to the procurement officer or to the CEO or what have you. But if they can explain your pricing and also how it likely will change over time, that's a really positive sign, I'd say.
Awesome. Rich, thank you so much for the time. Really, really enjoyed it.
I really enjoyed it. My pleasure. Thank you.